I think I put a new battery in there. Yeah, I know it was. I think I did put a new battery in there.
Is that the 9-volt? Is that the 9-volt you put in here?
No, that's, I don't think they used a 9-volt. They used something else.
I guess I closed those doors now.
Yes, okay.
I am. Who can afford enough? I can't afford it.
Keeps you young, Fred.
Yeah. Brian?
Everybody's getting quiet. Everyone's getting quiet. I don't even need to say it.
That's what it's all.
Can y'all hear me in the back?
No, speak up.
Speak up? It doesn't seem like. Can I get a little more sound?
You're
okay.
Right. You're echoing now.
I'm echoing now. Okay. Well, welcome. This is, how many years have we been at this, Bob?
About 33 years,
something like that. Dallas Luster Swarm kicking off the 2012-2013 season. I'm Rob Olson, the president of Dallas Luster Swarm, and welcome everyone to, I'll say it's the 33rd year. We appreciate everyone coming out. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. And how many heard about us through Meetup? Anybody? Okay, so there's four. Okay, that's awesome. Okay, so we were hoping we could get some good response from Meetup. So do y'all use that for several of your different clubs? Or?
Yes.
Okay, good. That's great. So kicking off the season, I want to introduce all of our officers. First off, there's David Drum, Vice President. Jeff Youngkin, our treasurer, man with the money. Carla Kraft, secretary, keeps all of our notes and keeps us, gets our speakers all coordinated. Ken Sauter, AV specialist and webmaster, has done a great job updating our webmaster. And Carl Meisenbach, public relations and marketing specialist. I don't know if Carl's here.
Carl. Yeah, I don't think he is.
Yeah, I think, and Carl helped us get us set up on Meetup. So if you haven't already, you haven't paid yet, please do so after the lecture. You can pay Jack. It's $5. Students with an ID can attend for $2. Any students here tonight? No students? Okay, they're all back in school studying, I guess. And I want to remind everyone to pay for your meal. Every once in a while, someone inadvertently forgets to pay, and then Dallas Luster Swarm pays. And we're a non-for-profit organization. And so we would appreciate you making sure you take care of your bill. Now we have a website, and I mentioned Ken has done a great job getting that up to date, and that is Dallas, let's see, that's flosserswarm.com.
.org.
Yeah, .org. www.flosserswarm.org. And then if you want to get updates on meetings, you can go to meetup.com and then type in Dallas Luster Swarm, and then you can get signed up that way. And I think you can go into our website, right, Ken, and then sign up through Meetup.
Yeah, you can sign up through the website, or you can send me an email, doesn't matter.
Right, okay. So now I'd like to bring up David Drum. David Drum, can you come up here? David is an immediate past president of Dallas Luster Swarm and has been a fantastic president for the last 3 years. He helped regenerate this group, and a former treasurer, and extraordinary leadership skills. And we want to present you with a gift certificate with Amazon.com to express our appreciation.
Thank you.
And I know if you go on Amazon.com, there's at least three or four philosophy books. That's right. Okay. And then finally, I ask you to turn off your cell phones. We'll put them on vibrate mode. Now I'd like to introduce our speaker. This is Dr. Fred Grinnell. He's a longtime speaker with Dallas Luster Swarm over the course of many years. He is professor of cell biology at UT Southwestern Medical Center. He earned his PhD in biochemistry at Tufts University. Now, where is Tufts?
Boston.
That's the city that has about 15...
Chinatown.
It has about 15 top-flight universities in the Boston area. Sorry? What's that?
It's
where Daniel Dennett teaches.
Daniel Dennett, yes. Tufts University.
He teaches at the main campus.
Okay. Dr. Grinnell joined the faculty at UT Southwestern in 1972, still working strong, hard every day, so you've been there 40 years, and founded the Ethics in Science and Medicine Program and Ethics Grand Rounds in 1998. Now, what is Ethics Grand Rounds?
It's a monthly program that brings nationally known speakers to the medical center to talk about contemporary issues, medical ethics, bioethics.
Okay, very good. So you're the founder of that. He has spoken at Dallas Lecturers Forum on several occasions. As I mentioned last time, it was about 3 years ago. He will be speaking tonight on the new language of genetic medicine and its implications for the ethical conduct of human research. Please join me now in welcoming Dr. Fred Grinnell.
So I want to stand somewhere where I'm not blocking people's view of things. Is this okay?
Yeah.
I want to get my water. Maybe I should get the water. Bob and I have been here since the beginning. So, and we used to be at a Greek restaurant over on Northwest Highway. That's where we started. And I noticed this group is moving further and further east as time goes on. So I was told that I should speak for 45 to 50 minutes, and then we would have 15 to 20 minutes for a discussion. So I'm going to speak for 45 to 50 minutes. However, if there is something that comes up in the course of my comments that's a point of something you really don't understand, then please, you know, yell out or raise your hand or whatever so that we can get clarification, so we don't, you know, at the end of 45 minutes discover that that it was totally non-communication between us. Okay. So what I'm going to do is talk first about how I got interested, just briefly, in human research ethics, and then I'm going to talk briefly about how I got interested in genetic medicine. And those two sets of comments will provide the sort of basis for then the subsequent things that I'm going to tell you about the new language of genetic medicine and its implications for human research. Okay, so I have throughout my career been interested in this molecule, fibronectin. Fibronectin is a biological adhesive molecule. It's one of the first biological adhesive molecules to have been discovered. And it does a lot of different things, and I was interested in it, particularly in the context of wound repair. And I was fortunate enough to have a chance to interact with these two guys at the medical center, Charlie Baxter, who was the head of the Burn Center, and Paul Bergstresser, who was the chair of dermatology. And these guys introduced me to the clinical side of wound repair. And I learned from them about things like this wound, which is called a venous stasis ulcer. It's very large. You can see it's 6 centimeters long. This woman had this on her leg. These ulcers are a problem of aging. And so it's a real difficult issue how you treat these. So we decided that we were going to try to treat these with fibronectin. And I had friends at the New York Blood Center who had made a very large amount of fibronectin to use for clinical studies, and they were looking for partners. So I said, hey, we'll partner with you. So we started a randomized, which means that as patients signed up, we put them either in the treatment group or the control group, 3-week treatment with fibronectin test solution. So half the patients got fibronectin on their ulcers, half the patients got a test solution that had protein but not fibronectin, so they couldn't tell the difference. The physicians who were giving them, or the nurses who were giving them this material, didn't know which was which, and that was it. Then I had a woman who enrolled, an African-American woman who had bilateral ulcers. She had one on each leg. Charlie Baxter, for those of you, no, you don't know him, but I see you're smiling. Charlie Baxter was a kind of out there guy. I mean, he was the most important, and still probably, he's not alive anymore, but did more for burn care in the rural, probably, than anybody else. And so if you're treated, if you have a big burn, you get the Parkland formula, that's all Baxter. So Baxter says, let's randomize our ulcers. Let's treat one of our ulcers with fibronectin and one of our ulcers with control, because that was sort of an internal control. Well, this is human research, and for reasons I'll explain to you, I had to get permission, but I got permission and we did that. And at the end of 3 weeks, we said to her, thank you very much. And she says to us, what do you mean, thank you very much? She says, whatever you've been doing to my right leg, it feels better than it's felt in the last 5 years. It's getting better. I want you to keep doing that. And whatever you've been doing to my left leg, I want you to stop and start doing what you've been doing to my right leg. So we were totally unprepared. I was totally unprepared for that. And I didn't know how to respond, because first place, the New York Blood Center didn't give us lots of fibronectin. And the second place, what if what we were doing to her right leg was the placebo and fibronectin the other side? There were all sorts of possibilities. We don't know what's going on. So this got my interest in why she didn't understand when we said, thank you very much, the experiment is over, why she didn't understand that. So I decided I had to learn more about human research. So I started studying human research and human research ethics, and the starting point is the Nuremberg trials in 1947 after World War II. When there were a number of kinds of atrocities in relationship to human research that led to these the doctors' trials, and coming out of this was the Nuremberg Code. But in the United States, we didn't sign on to that code. We just knew about it. And in 1966, this is, 20 years later, an article appears in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it starts by a guy at Harvard, and it starts out, human experimentation since World War II has created some difficult problems with the increasing employment of patients as experimental subjects when it must have been apparent that they would not have been available if they had been truly aware of the uses that would be made of them. So you might think that would get us to do something. But no, we didn't do anything. This is the United States. It wasn't until 1972 when the Tuskegee syphilis experiment became front page on the New York Times, and it turned out that the Public Health Service was allowing African-American crop workers to go untreated with syphilis because they wanted to find out what the natural course of the disease was. So after that came out, the Congress finally said, okay, we need some kind of national regulatory framework in the United States. And that they appointed a commission. That commission produced the Belmont Report in 1979. And that report established the procedural mechanism that we still use to this day, where for an investigator to do research with humans, their research has to be approved by an IRB, an institutional review board. So every single university, every hospital that wants to, any pharmaceutical company, has to turn at some point to an institutional review board if they want to do human research. And the basic principles that came out of that report were threefold. The first was the idea of respect for persons. We need to respect persons, and that means that you really have to get their consent. And that consent has to be informed. That was the first. The second was the idea of beneficence, which means that one has to maximize the benefits while minimizing the risks to the subject of the research. And the third was justice. And that was the idea that we have to recruit subjects in a fair manner. And we have to make sure that we're not using one set of subjects to benefit another group. That's 1979. It took a very long time. It's remarkable how long it took. But by 1982, That's 3 years later, the first paper appeared that said, it doesn't work. Can't work. And this was a paper called The Therapeutic Misconception. And the idea of the therapeutic misconception is that people agree to do research, but they don't really think it's research. They really think it's therapy. They really think they're getting treated. So, I realized when I read about the therapeutic misconception that that's what happened in our case. Because if you think about a research protocol, at the beginning of the protocol, therapy and research begin the same. Unless it's just a safety test, and we'll leave that aside, somebody has a problem, they come to see, you know, it's not being taken care of, and they hear that there's an experimental treatment, and so they sign up for the experimental treatment, they go to a healthcare provider, they're in a healthcare setting, and they get treated. It's not until the end that the distinction becomes clear. Because if it's therapy, then the treatment continues as long as the person is getting better. But if it's research for the subject, the treatment stops at the end of the experiment, even if the patient is getting better, even if they're going to get worse afterwards. So there are things called compassionate care, and there are sometimes situations where this can be, you know, not come into play. But in general, this is the way research is. That's the difference between therapy and research. And it's very hard for somebody to understand that. And it's very hard for somebody who's doing research to explain that difference. Okay, so that's my interest in human research, where it started. 10 years later, Dallas got at the UT Southwestern Medical School, got the Reynolds Foundation-sponsored Dallas Heart Study, which was a study that's going to go out into the community. It's going to begin especially in the African-American community. It's going to do a genetic analysis and try to discover genetic markers that are associated with heart disease. And so when this comes up, at the beginning, the people who, you know, were creating this had to have developed informed consent documents. And this is one of the areas that I was working in. I was asked to be part of the committee that created these documents. I had never thought about genetics before. So there's some special questions that came up I thought about. Well, what are the risks or the benefits to the subject of collecting data about their DNA? So that's sort of like the key. And what do you tell them about the access to their DNA by others who are not part of the study, both inside the institution and out of the institution? And what do you do if you find out something about their DNA 5 years later that's totally incidental, but indicates to you that they're a high risk for something that you had nothing to do with the original study? It's a heart study. What if you find out that they're at risk for osteoporosis or something, you know, some other, so it's unrelated disease because they have some genetic linkage? And one of the consequences of all this is that I realize that these experiments don't have endings. They go on essentially forever. It's a never-ending experiment. Okay, so that's how I started thinking about this. And as I started thinking about genetics and how you talk to people about genetics, I began to come up with this idea that genetic medicine modifies the meaning of words that we use commonly in everyday life experience. And so that's what I'm going to talk about: disease, treatment, and patient. And if you want to learn more, you can buy my book. Okay? And Everyday Practice of Science, Chapter 5, is called Informed Consent and Risk, the Intersection of Human Research and Genetics. And it's that material in that chapter is basically the content of what I'm going to tell you about now. Okay, so first we'll talk about the meaning of disease. So 150 years ago, or 100 years ago, maybe even 75 years ago, disease was dis-ease. Even if you don't go out, you were dis-eased. You went and you saw your healthcare provider and said, healthcare provider, what's wrong with me? So then what happened? Well, then we begin to get physiology and all of these ways of doing tests. And we find out what normal is. So now you feel great. You go to see your doctor for your checkup, and you find out you have hypertension, you have osteoporosis, you have all this stuff. You go there feeling great, you leave feeling sick, right? So your physician knows that you're diseased before you do. You haven't even become diseased yet. You just developed the physiology that predictably will lead to that. Genetics is a linkage that's not even there. It's you might get this physiology at some point in the future. So when we talk about genetics and disease and genetics, we're talking about something that might happen sometime later. It hasn't even happened now. That's a completely different way of thinking than we're normally used to thinking about what disease is. So how did this happen? Well, we started out trying to understand what causes disease. And we discovered there's abnormal physiology. And sometimes we found out that there were families that had this abnormal physiology shared. So we said, there's some genetic difference that we could try to discover, and we found that out. All of this is post-symptomatic, that disease came first, and then the studies to understand the genetics. But once you have this running in this direction, you can turn it and send it back in the other way. Now, you can do pre-symptomatic testing and say, do you have the genetic difference? And if you do, then you can predict, you might get the abnormal physiology. And if you get that, you might get the disease. So there's this total switch from trying to understand something after it's happened to predicting that something might happen, but those predictions are pretty weak. So now, if you look at, this is the list, a long complicated list from the Institute of Medicine, came out earlier this year. This is their imagination of all the different ways that genetic information will be used. And these guys up here are relate to post-symptomatic, so that we'll use genetics to confirm what your disease is, or we'll use genetics to figure out what your pharmacological type is for certain interventions, or we'll use genetics for tissue typing. All of these things have to do with what might happen in the future. You're going to find out your whole DNA sequence, so what does that tell you? You're going to do prenatal screening. You're going to have all of these different things that you're going to learn what your genetic linkage is sometime in the future. So is that going to happen to us? What are the risks of learning about that? Well, you might learn something about yourself that once you learn it, you wish you didn't know. That's viewed as the most significant risk of learning this information. And that psychological impact is right now. It's not in the future. And there's no way of reversing. And there's no way of knowing what's going to happen in the future. You might have a genotype that you think is not worth marrying, or reproducing, or leaving an inheritance. And you might find out something later about your DNA. Not now, later. And not only that, your DNA might turn out not to be private. There's a lot of concern about whether or not we can really guarantee the privacy of DNA information once it's out there. And I'll tell you, there have been some studies about how much is stored of our tissue. How many people here have sometimes been in the hospital to have any kind of treatment? You all have your tissue stored. Everybody has it. Mm-hmm. 282 million biological specimens in 1998, adding 20 million a year. These are these little, they say what we can do with any stuff. They come from 65% of the U.S. population, and they were all obtained, these specimens, without any explicit permission for genetic research. So nobody knows exactly what to do with them. So there's a big question. Can they be used for research on genetics? So we'll just leave it. So DNA, you think, is only part of the story. Okay, so here's like, for instance, an article that came out in Science Translational Medicine in April, the intro line in the New York Times about it says, study says DNA power to predict illness is limited. And that is accurate, that statement. So if you look at a lot of different diseases, they're sort of, just like there are three laws of thermodynamics, there are three laws of genetics. One is that health has a genetic component, okay? It is influenced by heredity. That genetic component is more than the influence of the family you grow up in. But both of those two things together are way less than everything that happens to you after you leave home. So 60 to 70%, for instance, of most cancers are totally unrelated to whether or not, these are all based upon twin studies. You follow twins, you know where they were brought up, and you can figure out what the genetic linkages are. So it's 60 to 70% of what happens to us in terms of genetics is unpredictable. Anything that happens. That's a pretty high percentage. But that's not what we hear. What we hear and what most people learn is the idea of genetic essentialism. You are your genes. And the scientific community does a great job of promoting that. This is Francis Collins, who's the head of NIH. This is his new book, The Language of Life. Your life depends on the secrets of your DNA. Are you ready? Okay. So that's the implication is that it's all about essentialism, and essentialism is an invitation to eugenics, which I'm going to talk about now. That's using genetics to make better people instead of to make people better. I love that definition. Okay? So eugenics was viewed as the primary risk of the Human Genome Project, or one of them, by the Office of Technology Assessment. New technologies for identifying traits in altering genes make it possible for eugenic goals to be achieved through self-selecting technologies as opposed to government-imposed social control. So that was the concern, and that's the potential direction. For those of you who are not familiar with genetics, eugenics, the word means good genes. It's a word from that was introduced by Francis Galton. Galton was Darwin's cousin. And, you know, Galton was very impressed. He was thinking that how can we use social control to improve future generations? He wrote, if a 20th part of the cost and pains were spent in measures for the improvement of the human race that is spent on the improvement of the breed of horses and cattle, what a galaxy of genius we might not create. And he published these ideas about eugenics in a series of papers in the 1860s. So Galton's idea about good genes was picked up by this guy, Alfred Plotz, who introduced the term Rossen hygiene, racial hygiene, in 1885, started a journal called Archive for Racial and Social Biology. Basically, he had a different take. He said, what's happened is that we've had a degeneration of the quality of the human race because we save people who would normally die as a consequence of disease and other factors. So we intervene, we save them, and now we're going down. The better the medicine gets, for instance, the worse off our race gets. So welfare for the sick and the inferior, forget it, we shouldn't be having it. So Plotz's ideas were picked up and became very popular in the United States. And the central organizing group for these ideas with the Cold Spring Harbor Labs Eugenic Records Office. And Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories, of course, today is one of the most famous biomedical research institutions in the country. But back then, it was interested in a lot of other things, including eugenics. This is the annual meeting of the Eugenics Research Association, June 1918. Okay, the character of a nation is determined primarily by its racial qualities, is the position that Cold Spring Harbor Eugenics group pushed. They had a tremendous influence on immigration policy. They testified before the House regarding the need to keep out undesirable genetic types. They were specifically focused on Jews and Italians. And the bills that were passed, and others as well, but the bills that were passed as a result of that created quotas. They also, that was the Immigration Restriction Act of 1924, and they also were in favor of sterilization of undesirables. People whose behavior was inadequate. And they created a kind of a standardized way of thinking about sterilization, and eventually a bunch of states in the United States adopted their ideas, and they finally it came to the Supreme Court of the United States in 1927 in the case of Buck versus Bell, where the state Buck was a woman who was going to be sterilized, and the state of Virginia was wanting to do that. And when the Supreme Court heard the case and heard all the arguments, the ruling was, it is better for all the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. That's our United States Supreme Court. It's pretty remarkable, okay, 1927. The important thing is not that that's the way we think now, but we have that kind of history in the United States, and it's kind of hidden. People don't know about it. And it influences at some point how we think. After Justice Wendell Holmes stated this, and it became legal, there were something like 60,000 Americans who were sterilized, 60,000 American women between 1927 and the 1970s, you know, following this. And then, of course, this practice disappeared. Okay, so much for what's a disease. What's a treatment? That's a whole other issue. So one way of thinking about treating a genetic disease would be gene therapy. Gene therapy is like way off in the distance. We don't know how to repair defective genes. We don't know how to replace defective genes. The only thing we could do is add a functional gene. And so right now, if you look at the way gene therapy is used, there are about 2,000 gene therapy protocols going on in the world. Most of it is for cancer therapy. It's not for correcting genetic diseases. It's for using genes to help as a therapeutic agent. Here's the slice for genetic diseases. 8.5%. These are the monogenetic diseases that one might imagine if you used gene therapy, you could correct the absence of the gene product that's missing. So it's mostly novel therapy with genes. If it did work, when would you want to use it? And the answer is early, because genetic disorders influence lots of different kinds of cell types. So the best time to intervene would be before birth. That would be the time to do gene therapy, as early as possible. Embryos and fetuses would be the best candidates. But now imagine what's going to happen if you try to do that. The outcomes are unpredictable. So what would one do with the failures? So we have no clue. That's not the way we think. You know, we would have to change entirely our attitudes about what one does with human organisms that we think are for some reason unsatisfactory. So we can leave that whole idea aside and then think about another aspect of this notion of how you treat genetic diseases. If you think about the medical genetics specialty, there are a couple elements to it. One is genetic counseling, another is therapeutic intervention, another is prevention. Okay, so this is the classic example that everybody points to as a sort of successful way of thinking about gene therapy intervention or genetic information. And it started actually before it was a genetic test. It was originally just a biochemical test. And you were looking, every baby was screened to see if they, what their levels were of phenylalanine in the bloodstream. If they had PKU, phenylketonuria, then you knew that you had to get them on a special phenylalanine-free diet immediately. Otherwise, they would develop severe neurological issues. Now, that's not an easy diet. It's not pleasant, but it manages to completely prevent the neurological condition from emerging. So you might think of that as a successful intervention. And here's an example of pharmacological, this is the poster child for pharmacogenetics, because it turns out that there are two kinds of genes that people have associated with the way that the drug Coumadin or warfarin is processed. And depending on one of these genotypes processes it poorly, one of it processes it well. So you don't want to, if you want to predict what your blood levels of the drug are, you want to make sure you know your genotype. So now there actually is a website where you go to after you find out the person's genotype. You put in their height, their weight, their age, their sex, their genotype, and it tells you what the right dosage is. Because that's pharmacogenomics at its best. Now, here's a slightly more complicated, more difficult example. So a paper came out about a year ago describing a multi-center a trial involving women who had tested positive for BRCA1 or BRCA2. These are the breast cancer-associated genes that, if there's certain mutations in them, increases dramatically the likelihood of breast and ovarian cancer. So a large number of the women who were part of this trial chose to have prophylactic removal, total removal of their breasts and ovaries. None of those women developed any disease. And a reasonable number of women who didn't have that did develop disease. So think about that as a new way of prevention. You remove the part of the body that might be affected. So that's a different notion of prevention. And here's yet another kind of prevention. This was a paper, an article in the New York Times about 10 years ago. Ashkenazi Jews vanquish a disease. The disease is Tay-Sachs disease. So it's a relatively high-frequency genetic disease in the Jewish community, high enough so that the real effort was made to test prospective partners throughout the Jewish community. Back in the 1970s, I got tested. And everybody found out whether you were Tay-Sachs, whether you were a carrier or not. If you're a carrier, there's no risk. But if you're a carrier, the person you marry is a carrier, and you have a kid, and then there's a 1 in 4 chance that kid will get the defective gene from mom and the defective gene from dad, and if they do, then the kid will have the disease. So they did this widespread screening. Everybody knew the disease is almost gone from the community. Prevent the person who might get the disease. That's another view of prevention. You know, normally we think of disease prevention, you know, we say, well, you know, drink moderately, exercise. We're talking about preventing an individual from getting the disease. Now we're talking about removing the tissue that might get the disease or preventing the person. So the new meaning of disease prevention, prevent the person. Avoid the marriage, don't have children. Don't implant the embryo if you do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or abort the fetus if you get that the information that these are all possibilities now to prevent the person. And there are companies that are, you know, have grown up to do just this. This is the website for console. 2010, the Wall Street Journal Innovation Award. Okay? We will do one test. We'll test you, we'll test Dad, for 100 plus genetic diseases. And then we can decide, once you find out what genetic diseases you might have, what to do. We can do early testing. We can do testing with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So this is an embryo. Or we can just, if we don't do that, then we can have testing during pregnancy and we can watch. There are all sorts of options. So, you know, this testing during pregnancy is very risky. So there are two standard methods up till now. One is called chorionic villus sampling, one is called amniocentesis. Each of them have about a 1% risk of a miscarriage. So 1 in 100. So you're not going to do that if you don't think you're at risk. If you have some reason that you think you really might be at risk, okay, so you're going to do that. But it's not going to automatically do something that is a 1% chance of a miscarriage. But this is invasive prenatal diagnostic testing. And now we have something new. What we have new is non-invasive prenatal diagnostic testing. So somebody discovered, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, that if you look in the blood of mom, you find DNA and RNA from the fetus. And now the techniques are becoming good enough to analyze those and distinguish those so that you can just do a blood test on mom and find out a lot about the fetus she's carrying. Now, right now, the information you can find out is pretty limited. You can find out about the trisomies. You can find out about some strange things about chromosomes. That's all. But 10 years from now, you're going to know everything. You're going to know what kind of kid you're carrying. Okay. And there already is companies that are beginning to offer what they call the next generation of prenatal testing. It's the whole thing. Non-invasive, pre-implantation, this is beforehand, and genetic carrier screening or miscarriage afterwards. So that's where we are at. And if you think that people don't make decisions based upon this kind of information, a great article is in the New Atlantis in the fall of 2011 called The Global War Against Baby Girls. And if you look at, by any criteria, these are charts, three different kinds of charts for three different areas of the world, what you find is that the selective abortion of baby girls is a very widespread practice, not just in China, but all over the world. So not in the United States, not in many countries, but in many areas of the world, there's an abnormal ratio of the number of boys and girls that are born, and it's all attributed to selective abortion. So you can imagine if this is going on now, what's going to, you know, what will people do when they find out about the genetics of their unborn child if they think those genetics are not good? If they believe that those genetics determine what kind of person that will be. So that's the eugenic risk. Okay, so that's the treatment, and now patient. So we have... we have, the technomedicine has already given us different kinds of patients. We have the fragmented body, that's the person we all go, you know, you go see your cardiologist or your podiatrist or your psychiatrist. Yeah, somebody different for each part, right? And they don't talk to each other. So you're basically fragmented. But then we also, with high tech, have the mosaic body where you get some part from somebody else, like a heart. And we also have the new, you know, sort of brain, maybe not dead, but brain non-functional body where you're on internal life support. So these are all, these are all typical patients, but they're one body. Now we have two new kinds with genetics. We have the many-person body, and we have the single-cell body. Those are the new patients. The many person body creates the problem of what's called secondary subjects. Okay, and you can think about this initially in terms of psychosocial research. So somebody is a psychologist, they're doing a research project, they come and they ask me about my children. Or they come and ask my children about me. So now they're getting information about me, let's say, from my children without my permission. So I'm a secondary subject. I haven't given permission. They did informed consent with my kid. They don't have to get my permission. Well, think what happens in genetics. My kid may be giving them the wrong information. She just may not know. He may not know. But in genetics, if I have a twin, and this is our family, and they get information, genetic information about my twin, they will automatically get all sorts of information about me. But they don't have to ask me. But unavoidably, I've become a secondary subject. So this is a big issue. Is informed consent required? No answer. And then there's the single cell patient, the embryo, which is at the center of everything. In vitro fertilization, genetic testing, embryonic stem cells, cloning, gene therapy. We talked a little bit, you know, about some of these, but really not much. But the embryo is where the action has to be. And that's because it's the perfect genetic patient. It's the pure genetic patient. If you think about white as genetics and blue as life experience, the embryo has almost no life experience. It's all genetics. If you want to influence it, the genetics, the best time to do it is then. If you wait, the longer you wait, the less genetic impact you can have, the more you have the adult history that establishes the way it's going to be. So the embryo is ideal. And so this is the free-living embryo, enhanced, because, in a sense, enhanced because it's free-living. Embryos normally aren't free-living. It's only modern science that's made the possibility, reproductive science, of having a free-living embryo. Up until, you know, 1970, embryos only existed in moms. There were no embryos that were free-living. Well, once you have a free-living embryo, then you have to ask, well, what is it? What's the difference between the embryo body and the embryo person? And those of you who follow science policy know that there's a gigantic debate on that subject because it all centers around the issue, when does the person arrive? The ontological perspective says the person is there all along, for instance, the Catholic Church. The existential perspective, most scientists, say the person emerges over time. That there's a separation between the genetic individual and the person. And this is in the courts, it's a big deal. Okay, so just about at the end here, genetic research and informed consent. Well, when it comes to disease, it's difficult to specify what are the risks and benefits, because disease is something that might happen, but we don't know if it will happen. When it comes to treatment, we have all of these issues with eugenics and the notion of preventing the person. We're not sure who the patient is, at least in some cases, what to do about secondary subjects and whether or not it's okay to do research on embryos. And then finally, we have the problem of the never-ending experiment. So these are all challenges to informed consent in genetic research. So given these increased uncertainties, the question is informed consent still possible? Or has the very notion, the classical notion of informed consent, be compromised? So there's a neat way of thinking about science that emerged from the environmental field in trying to understand different aspects of how science is practiced and managed. And there's an idea of different levels of science, one of which is what's called post-normal science. So here, down at this sort of end here, at this axis, where the decision stakes are low and the uncertainties are low, this is what is called applied science by these authors, and it really means that I can make the decisions of what to do in my laboratory. Okay, my oversight is sufficient. There really aren't other stakeholders, it's okay. But then you get to this level here,
where the decision stakes are higher, the uncertainties are higher. Now there are human stakeholders at different levels, and so now we need extended peer review in order to decide what's okay to do or what's not. This involves managers and end users. And if you think about human research, you can think about the Institutional Review Board and subject-informed consent as being ways of fulfilling this idea. But then we get to post-normal science. The traditional fact-value distinction no longer can be separated. And the uncertainty even includes what's ethical, like we have in the case of the embryo. Now the question is, what's going to happen? What should we do? And I don't have an answer, but I have some guesses as to where things, I think, are heading or ought to be heading. The first is that we need to democratize decision-making. And actually, this is a recommendation of Clinton's Bioethics Advisory Committee 11 years ago. It says, IRBs must be able to put risks and benefits into a social context in order to judge how ordinary citizens would value them. So IRBs have always been thought about as being focused on the science, but they say it must have a social element as well, and so they wanted to expand the non-scientific composition of IRBs, which most people can't figure out how to do. For all sorts of logistic reasons. But that's the idea of democratization. The second is, I think, that there's this real need to teach in our institutions, like medical schools, about eugenics and the history of sociobiology. So that physicians, because the physicians are going to be the ones who are going to have to become, as a whole group, genetic counselors. Everybody's going to want genetic counseling. It's not just that we have a few genetic counselors to deal with a few people. Every single person before long is going to send their DNA off to some company and get back a readout and find out everything about themselves. And then the next time they go, you know what happens now. You go to the doctor and you've read on the web all the things that might be going on. And so the doctor says something to you, and you start arguing. Well, now, wait a second. And the physician probably says to you, why don't you wear a white coat next time you come in, you know? So we need physicians to really understand about the eugenic history and implications, because that will be in people's minds. And we need to especially stop, you know, presenting genetics in this essentialistic way that we tend to do. And then the last thing is, I think that we're going to have the social political controversy that we have now is just going to expand, because the more prenatal genetic diagnostic testing we do, the more information that moms are going to have, and the more opportunities for them to make the decision to abort. And so the more people are going to want to do embryo testing. So all of these things are going to create the kind of social controversy. So, and we'll have to deal with this question at some point. Does the human body equal the human person? All right, so that's it. And now it's open for discussion. Thank you very much.
Comments at a minimum before you get to your, and then ask your questions.
It was very interesting and very good. I feel like it went through my mind when you talked about democratization. You're bringing in people who have no scientific understanding and bring all their prejudices and all their misunderstandings and religious views and so forth into the picture that has no business being in the picture. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so what Bob is alluding to is and that's why I said that from a logistic point of view, nobody knows how to deal with democratization, because it's an ideal. But the people who you bring in don't have any knowledge, and they bring all their prejudices. So how do you democratize the process? There's, on one hand, the feeling that it needs to somehow be democratized, but nobody knows how to go about doing it. So that's exactly right. So you have exactly expressed the reason why nothing has happened since that recommendation, because nobody knows how to do it.
Okay.
Yes, you mentioned cloning briefly. I guess you passed over it, but doesn't that alter the whole perspective on this last question you raised about does the human body equal the human person? Because if you took a little piece of your skin off your arm, you could separate it out into thousands of cells, which could each have a potential of being the same as an embryo.
Well, what a better world it would be too if it was all me, right?
Well,
I think that the cloning issue is pretty interesting because there's a new technique that's been developed in UK, and UK has always been the leaders in this field. They're the ones. It was in the UK that it was first learned how to culture an embryo. And they developed a very robust oversight system and policy system. So there are some people who have mitochondrial disorders associated with their mitochondria. I guess in the last couple of years, UK reproductive biologists or physicians have been experimenting with the idea of taking an embryo from a mom or from a couple that or an ovum, and taking out the nucleus and putting in the fertilized nucleus from the couple. So now you have a three-parent embryo. And this is actually a kind of cloning, because you now have the DNA, the mitochondrial DNA, from the donor, and you have the rest of the DNA from the mom and the dad.
So you got rid of the bad mitochondrial DNA.
Yeah. So this technique really is going to create the research base that would ultimately effectively allow cloning to occur. There'll be enough learned about in the course of doing this. I don't know what will happen with cloning.
Okay. I have a second comment, too, about whether this big controversy that's become a political issue about whether the person is emergent or whether the person is there at the instant of conception. I mean, that's relevant to cloning, for one thing. But I also think that the scientific idea of emergence is really what the Supreme Court, so it's a legal issue, the Supreme Court has said that the, the wrong that's done in abortion depends on the stage of the abortion. So if you extrapolate back to saying at the instant of conception there's very little harm done, then that might be a reasonable point of view to put along with the scientific point of view.
Yeah, I think that what happens is that in some states there's an attempt to create legislation that simply ignores the sort of legalistic view and define that personhood begins with conception.
Yes.
And then once you do that, it makes it illegal to do all sorts of things.
Right.
So, and of course we have a congressional amendment. That's why you can't have, most people don't understand this. There's a congressional amendment that was passed a number of years ago associated with the authorization of federal funding for NIH, and that amendment says that it's illegal to do anything to harm a human embryo. And so that's why that the federal government can fund research on stem cells, for instance, but they can't fund research on embryos because those embryos would be harmed. And the current court case that's still unresolved, focuses on the intersection between those two, because NIH says, well, we're only working on stem cells that have been taken by other people in the private sector from embryos resulting in embryo destruction. And the people on the who are arguing against it say that, well, that to take those stem cells, you need to have embryos destruction. Therefore, what we're doing is encouraging embryo destruction, and so that's illegal according to the sense of that amendment that I mentioned. So that's where that's at.
Just want to comment on my appreciation for the reassurance earlier in our discussion that my doctors are fully informed, have no prejudices for religious views.
To what extent are the risks associated with the loss of genetic diversity taken into account as good genes and bad genes are being identified and policies are being made up now?
Yeah, so I don't know if everybody could hear the question about whether we're risking loss of genetic diversity and whether policymakers are considering that. I think policymakers are considering getting elected, and I don't think they're considering the science at all. In fact, we live in a world where the science that people believe in often depends upon what their social religious beliefs are. It's like global warming. You can either believe it or not believe it, depending upon, you know. Although more and more people are believing it as bad things happen. But I don't think we actually, as a community, have to worry about genetic diversity. I actually don't think a lot of this stuff is going to happen practically. I think I'll tell you what. So we talk about the gene for intelligence, but we don't know what intelligence is. Just the very word, you know, we can use the word, but we're not at all sure what that means exactly, and we don't really know how to measure it. And so if we don't know what it is to begin with, then how we have all of the uncertainty of genetics. So how is it going to ever come together? I just don't believe it's going to happen. So I think it's a myth. It's an illusion. It drives research interests, drives, you know, all sorts of, and good things come out in related to other aspects, but the idea that we're really going to be able to control all this stuff, it ain't going to happen. It's just not.
When you talked about democratization, you talked about gathering people who are very intelligent with this stuff, whatever, and dealing with people who weren't informed. The Nazis were extremely intelligent people, and they did some really horrible stuff. So how do we decide who's intelligent and just what intelligence is?
So let me give you an example of what the idea of democratization is. So we're doing research on people that relates to genetics. And the question is, are they in a position to know whether or not it's really good or bad for them? And maybe we feel like they're not really able to know that. But let's say that there's a community, an interest community. So think of HIV/AIDS and the gay community. So when HIV/AIDS came on the scene, the research that was being done very slowly. And it was following all the normal protocols, and we can't do this because you might damage the person, and et cetera, et cetera. And the gay community said, wait a second, we're all dying from this. We need a robust research program that is completely involved as fast as possible in trying to develop therapies for this disease. So you had an intersection between the disease community and the science community that totally changed what the science community was doing. You see the same thing in breast cancer. Okay, so that while it's true that just bringing in individuals isn't going to work, you do have communities of interest that are very knowledgeable and that have a vested interest in seeing the work done. And if they think it's important enough, they can say, we should waive the normal protections, you know, in order to move this forward. Now you still have, you know, the people who are on the more conservative, you know, creating those protections. But that is the ideal sort of, to me, of how democratization works. If you look at HIV/AIDS or if you look at the breast cancer community.
On the one hand, we have intelligence up in the upper
echelons, and we don't know how to measure it. We don't know what it is. I can see that. But on the other hand, we have intelligence in the lower echelons, the ones that are, we call retarded. And we all agree that there's something missing there. But, so we're on safe ground there, but where in this spectrum does it move from from definitely we've got retarded to we don't know?
I think that at this point, the question is, you know, how do we deal with, you know, we maybe not how to get really intelligent people, but maybe there are tests we can do to see whether or not it's likely that somebody is retarded. Well, Down syndrome is a good example where you know that from the genetic, from the chromosomal analysis, that this person is going to have Down syndrome. If they do, the chances are that their intelligence level is not going to be, you know, standard. It's going to be substandard, whatever that means exactly. And now what are you going to do about it as a parent? What sort of decision are you going to make? And then the decisions that get made are going to be depending upon the social religious beliefs of the couple or the mother, but the couple who are involved. So there are no standard lines that you can draw, because where you draw the line is going to depend upon the person who's making the decision. And so that for what's satisfactory for one family might be totally unsatisfactory for another. That's why I mentioned the global war against girls, because you know the selection, the decision to abort baby girls is totally a social decision in some societies. And in the United States, we probably think they're nuts. But that's what they're doing. And so, you can understand when you see that kind of data, the impact that social beliefs can have on decisions that are made about genetics. So.
That seems like population control killing off the girl babies.
No, well, I don't know. There are all sorts.
It's not organized. It's an unorganized. I understand the customs involved.
That's correct. It's not organized at any governmental level. It's a familial decision.
Of course.
That's made, and it's made for social reasons.
And one of the unintended consequences may be population control.
There are all sorts of unfortunate, unintended consequences.
There are many of them for doing that.
Right.
Social reasons, too.
Question back here. Yeah, I wanted to ask a question to follow on your the example you gave about gay community and how the scientific community responded for faster research. So if you look at this genetics or the genomics based medicine, is this a response to the community because there's a demand coming, or is the scientific community is actually doing, entertaining that because now we can do it?
So everybody hear the question, are the people asking for the genetics, or is science, you know? No, I think that it's the latter. That is to say that people obviously want to get better, but typically what happens is that science takes advantage of opportunities. And it became clear, you know, beginning in the late 1990s, that the opportunity was there to perhaps sequence the human genome. And the assumption was that that would have an extraordinary impact on health-related issues. Anybody who's interested in reading, you know, real science, you know, this stuff in real scientific terms, the latest issue of Nature magazine has in it what they're calling the genetic encoding. And there have been something like 20 or 30 papers published in the last month or so. So that, you know, only a very small part of the genome, it turns into proteins. And the large part of the genome is all regulatory in nature. And finally, there's been enough sequencing that we're beginning to be able to create like a roadmap for how all of these things interact. But I think it's the scientific community that drives it. The scientific community always wants to know more and understand how things work. And that, you know, it's like those... And as long as the public community benefits from it, then they support it.
But is there really a matrix for it? Do I just say that one public is benefiting, or is there a major disconnect we are talking about here?
So is there a metric? Okay, so that, I mean, the kinds of metrics you'd have to look at are things like life expectancy. And if you look at the change in life expectancy over the last 50 years or 100 years, you see it's dramatically increased. And some of that's due to public health, and some of it's due to discoveries like antibiotics. So I think that, you know, just sanitary conditions was a gigantic change in public health. So yeah, I think that you can measure, you can look around the world now and see that things as a whole are, that science has accomplished a lot, but at the same time, there are lots of unanticipated consequences. So we have global warming, we have pollution. We've been so successful at keeping people alive that we have overpopulation. So dwindling resources to feed all those people. So it goes together.
I had a question. You talked about control groups and experiment groups. I was just trying to think of a scenario where, let's say you have cancer research, and the experiment, you got the control group, the experiment group, and the experiment group patients do remarkably well after a period of several weeks. And is there an ethical concern about, if they are, this could save lives, of stopping the experiment and moving the people in the control group who are, their health is deteriorating rapidly, move them into the experimental group?
Yeah, so there was just a recent unfortunate case about a year ago of just the opposite situation, where there were two cousins who were being treated for advanced melanoma. And they were in not a placebo-controlled trial, but in a standard of care-controlled trial, where one was getting the old treatment, and the other one was enrolled to get the new treatment. And the new treatment, the preliminary study suggested, was going to be really good. But they needed to reach a certain number of patients before they could decide that, according to the design of the statistics of the experiment, et cetera, et cetera. And so despite the efforts of the family and the other people to get the cousin who was on the control onto the experimental, they did not. And after a few months, he died. His cousin stayed alive. And the family of the kid who died were very public in the New York Times and other places with their critique of the whole idea of controlled experiments. Fortunately, the opposite situation there's intervention immediately. So a good example is the woman's hormone replacement therapy experiments, which had a lot of expectations for positive things. It became very clear that something was not right in terms of the expectations, that women were not getting a benefit. In fact, there are some increases in heart attacks, heart-related incidents, and they stopped that whole protocol several years early. And they're still trying to figure out what went wrong, because they have all these animal studies, preclinical studies, everything says this stuff should work. Then they do the experiments and people and they don't work. Now you don't know why they don't work, because what they used in animals for progesterone and estrogen ratios aren't the same as using people, and there are all sorts of reasons why it might not have worked. So maybe it is good if you figure out the right way of doing it. But now, you know, once you get a negative answer, then it becomes much harder.
Last question.
I was just wondering, you know, how much potential do you think that the field of nanotechnology has come in and influence and potential change, genetic research and all
So the question is, what's going to happen with nanotechnology? The thing about nanotechnology or any kind of add-on technology is that, depending on how you do it, if you add it on, then you sometimes can take it off if you don't like what it's doing. Okay, so that so I think nanotechnology has extraordinary potential in terms of therapeutics. But you know, we already use nanotechnology in all sorts of products in our daily life. So I think it's a tremendously open field, and nothing but good stuff in terms of potential. But at the same time, we all know that there's always these risks of unanticipated consequences. So we don't know what the sort of the, you know, it's like thinking about asbestos. That was great, you know, for preventing fire. But then all these people came down with lung disease, and now every building that has asbestos in it, we have to go in and take it out. And when they go into it, the guys come in with the uniforms on and all the stuff. And so you're thinking about, oh, Jesus, it's the hazardous material, and I've been living there. And so nanotech is the same potential to come back and haunt us. And so we have to be very careful. Hopefully, we've learned, but, you know, who knows?
Okay, let's give a round of applause. If you haven't been,